69 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Both here in the United States and really all around the world, we are seeing an uptick in fascism. And in particular, we are seeing more and more young people drawn to fascist ideas. And it is cause for concern, of course, for anybody who sees the world differently. And one of the most interesting books on the topic that has just been published is called How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. The point of this book stems from the reality that fascist organizations recruit almost exclusively from young men, in some cases even young boys, and it is they who seem to be especially susceptible to the siren call of fascist organizations and to fascism itself. Craig Johnson has written a book which is, in a sense, a call to action as well as a guide for parents, especially perhaps teachers, mentors, family friends who might want to speak with a young boy, a young man who might be potentially falling under the influence of fascist ideals or fascist organizations. Craig Johnson is an independent journalist and an academic, and also the host of a podcast called 15 Minutes of Fascism. His book, How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism, is published by Routledge Studies in Fascism and the Far Right. Craig A. Johnson, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me. I wish we were talking about something, a little bit less sad, but here we are.
I certainly agree with you. I really do. Ahead of us, getting into the heart and soul of the book, I wonder if you could maybe explain to me and to our listeners why this has become the issue around which you are focusing so much of your professional energies and time. Did anything in particular galvanize you to want to explore this?
Well, as an academic and a scholar, my professional life, I study fascism and the right wing primarily in Latin America. And when I began this career, it was 2014. It was before Donald Trump's election. It was before his candidacy. And so at first people treated it sort of like a curiosity, which is essentially what I'd always hoped that studying fascism would seem like to people, like this little antiquarian off in the side studying this weird old thing. But unfortunately, as you and as your audience knows, fascism has become significantly more powerful, significantly more potent, not just in the United States, but around the world. And so I started getting, very different questions starting in 2016 when I would talk to people, at bars, at conferences, meeting friends. When I told them what I did, they would get stricken. They would get this like pale look on their faces and say, well, what am I supposed to do about this? People were worried, but they didn't know what to do. They'd maybe heard from activists about taking the streets if fascists are protesting. They'd maybe heard about how people get got by fascism, how they get organized by fascism. But there wasn't really a coherent, simple, small guide for what to do about it. And I decided to put my money where my mouth is and to write that guide, hoping that it would be useful to people, hoping that people would get something out of it.
I meant to, in my preparation for this conversation, to check out your podcast, 15 Minutes of Fascism, but did not have the opportunity. Can I assume that is of a similar intent, that you cover some of the same ground as you do in your book?
So the book is pitched as a practical guide for how to talk to someone about fascism. So it starts out being about what fascism is. There's just, you know, one short chapter saying, like, okay, here's the lowdown on what fascism is. And then it becomes a, you know, a practical guide about how young men get recruited into fascism, what to do about it. The podcast itself is more of a weekly news dump. You know, so think about maybe stories that you hear on this station, on other NPR affiliates, that are, you know, a 15-minute sort of like explainer about something that's happening in the world today. That's the podcast. It's a 15-minute explainer about what's going on in the world of fascism and the right wing, primarily in countries whose languages I speak. So mostly English, Spanish, Portuguese, but also some news from India, Japan, places like that.
Mm. We're speaking with Craig A. Johnson about his book, How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. And as you just said, you do spend some time, and I think it is time well spent, explaining exactly what fascism is and the fact that the history of fascism is, in a sense, a shorter history than I think a lot of us might assume. Before we dig into the emergence of fascism, let's dig into a definition so we are all on the same page, because I think, as you say more than once in the book, it is a term that is sometimes used carelessly and can be misinterpreted or misunderstood. So what is your best understanding? What is the understanding we are operating with today in terms of what fascism is?
You're absolutely right that there is a lot of debate, a lot of different definitions thrown around. You know, there's time and space for arguing about those things. I think that when it comes time to actual, you know, your behavior in your everyday life, that time has passed, right? When it comes to your everyday life, a rough and ready definition of fascism that I think is just useful and accurate is that fascism is a revolutionary right-wing movement whose goal is to transform the world through violence. And if you are calling something fascist and it meets all of those criteria, then I think you're pretty much on the ball. The reason that I adopt a definition of fascism like that is that it captures a lot of things that maybe aren't necessarily fascism, but that you need to treat in the same way. You know, one of the things I say in the book is that imagine your son is interested in Confederate nationalist revivals in the United States. Now, Confederate nationalism isn't necessarily fascist. You know, they're looking backwards instead of forwards. But you shouldn't, like, you know, heave a sigh of relief. Like, thank goodness my son isn't a fascist. He's just a, you know, a Robert E. Lee cosplayer, right? No, that's not a relief. You need to treat those in the same way.
Let's talk about one intriguing point you make in your chapter called What is Fascism, in which you talk about what you describe as a two-way relationship between fascists and conservatives. And of course, we need to reiterate probably again and again that those two terms are by no means interchangeable. We are talking about two different things, but there is, in a sense, potentially some overlap, and certainly also, as I just said, a two-way relationship in which one side will, in some respects, make use or take advantage of the other. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about. I think it's a profoundly important point.
Absolutely. This is one, I would agree with you, absolutely. This is one of the most important things to get across and to really understand about fascism. When people use fascism or fascist as an insult, right, you know, they're throwing it at everybody. You know, sometimes it seems like fascist just means anybody I don't like or anybody to the right of me, you know. But Donald Trump would call, you know, the socialist candidate for mayor in New York, he would call him a fascist, right? It just means anybody I don't like. But fascism is a right-wing movement. That's pretty much understood and agreed to by essentially everybody who pays very close attention to it. And that means that it can't be a left-wing movement. Fascists have a specific relationship with conservatives because conservatives are the mainstream of the right wing in the United States and in most of the Western world. So if we're thinking about the distinctions here, think about like, okay, well, the Republican Party has some fascist elements in it now. You know, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, people who want a big race war, want extreme mass deportations. A lot of those people might be described accurately as fascists. But there are other people in the Republican Party who maybe they hear that rhetoric and they don't get upset, but that's not exactly what they're there for. We might call these people Romney Republicans, right? People who are just conservative. They maybe want tightening of the U.S. budget. Maybe they want to question or roll back some LGBTQ protections, but they don't want like a national registry of all queer people or something like that, which maybe the fascists do want, you know. This two-way relationship between fascists and conservatives is instrumental. They use each other. Conservatives use fascists to do dirty work. And so we saw this starting with the first Trump administration, where fascists would provide quote-unquote security. You know, their job was to show up with guns and be intimidating to people, to scare people out of protesting. That's what conservatives use fascists for. But fascists use conservatives for something very different. They use conservatives to slingshot themselves into more power. The more conservatives use fascists to do their dirty work, the more power fascists have on the right wing. We saw this back in the 1920s and 1930s. The German conservatives used the Nazi Party in order to do their dirty work, to kill the left, basically, to kill communists and socialists. And I mean kill in a literal and figurative sense. So they stopped them electorally, and they also killed people physically. But it was that influence, that power that the conservatives gave the Nazis, that the Nazis were able to use to slingshot themselves into being the biggest party in the country. That would not have happened if the conservatives had turned their back on them. And so this is this instrumental relationship. They're both constantly using each other, vying for control on the right wing. A lot of what we're seeing today in the Trump White House is wrangling over who's going to be in charge. Is it going to be the sort of mainstream libertarian Christian nationalist types, or is it going to be actual out fascists who don't believe in democracy and want, you know, extreme mass deportation with thousands of police officers on the streets taking people out of their homes? You know, that's what we're seeing today.
I want to revisit the definition of fascism to just explore a couple of points just for greater clarity. Right at the outset, in explaining what fascism is, you say first, fascism is nationalist. And you go on to say that means that they think about politics in terms of nations rather than classes or interest groups. Fascists believe that their nation is the best in the world. I think what you go on to explain is that this can mean different things in different contexts. That is, when they are talking about the nation to which I belong, to which I love, that can mean different things to different people. How is that term typically used within this framework? And does that differ dramatically when we're talking about a young fascist here in the United States versus a young fascist in a place like India or South Africa or Britain or wherever they might be?
Absolutely. One of the things that people often misunderstand about fascism is that they think fascism is inherently about white supremacy. That is not the case. There have been many fascist movements. In fact, one of the most powerful and potent fascist movements in the world is in India. This is a political movement that's closely associated with the ruling party in India, the BJP. This political movement is called the RSS. It is a Hindu nationalist party. Now, by virtue of being a right-wing organization that's really powerful in the world, definitely they contribute to white supremacy by, you know, attaching themselves to or promoting the way the world currently works, which is organized around, you know, white supremacist violence. That's true. But the people that they want to be in charge of India are not necessarily light-skinned or white people. You know, they don't want to bring the British back. The RSS was one of the first big anti-colonial movements in British India and the British Raj. So fascism is nationalist is a better way to understand fascist racism. in the United States, white nationalists are extremely potent and powerful, and they have been since the, you know, since the dawn of the United States. And so that's the kind of nationalism that we see in the U.S. In other countries, fascist nationalism maybe looks a little bit different. It is often racial, but it's not necessarily racial.
When we're talking about the tenet of fascism as being critical of the government, how do we understand that? Because, of course, fascists might very well push hard for people who see the world as they do to become the head of the government or more widely represented in the government of where they live. Does this then inherent criticism of the government sort of evaporate or lessen or go away, or does that tend to be a complicating factor in all of this when the government at hand is not as clearly an opponent as it might otherwise be? I guess another way to ask this is, are fascists always critical of the government, regardless of who happens to be, in a sense, in power?
Yeah, I would say that fascists are always critical of the government. They are always opposed to the powers that be. You know, they're revolutionaries. They want to radically transform the government. One of the things that's unique about fascism in the United States and about the radical right wing in the United States in general is that it's pretty libertarian. It claims to want less government. Not all fascisms have wanted that. The Nazi Party was famously extremely regulatory. They even enacted a bunch of like environmental protections and workplace protections and, you know, welfare policies exclusively for the racial groups that they felt were worthy of them, right? In the United States, fascism is different. It comes from a more libertarian place that's critical of government as such. But all fascists have this problem, which is that, you know, they come to be in control of a government of a state that they hate, or at least that they ostensibly hate. And so they're in a position of saying, like, okay, well, either we have to destroy the state from within, or we have to, you know, take it over and keep only the parts that we want. It's a complicated calculus for them.
Fascinating. And another tenet that is kind of hard to wrap our heads around is that fascism is by its very nature sexist. That, and this is of course a point reiterated repeatedly in your book, that it is almost exclusively, although not absolutely exclusively, the domain of men, and in many cases the domain of young men. This might be a good point to talk about when fascism, as we are talking about it, first emerged just over 100 years ago. Explain the circumstances under which we first saw something that would be appear to be the first stage of fascism.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of arguments among scholars about, you know, when fascism started. Some people say that the actual first fascist organization was the first Klan, the first Ku Klux Klan in the United States. But it's generally agreed that the first fascist group that is unambiguously fascist was the one founded by Benito Mussolini after World War I. This organization was called fascist. He called it fascism, which was a term that was being thrown around at the time about a lot of political groups. At the time, fascist just meant like group or band of people who are sort of like-minded individuals joined together. Mussolini used this term to describe a network, an organization of World War I veterans. Before he landed on the term fascism, he was originally calling this movement a quote-unquote trenchocracy, as in a movement for government ruled by people who had been in the trenches. This is one of the main reasons that fascism is so inherently about youth and vigor and power. You know, he believed that the violence and power of their experience in World War I should propel them to national power. But it's also a very gendered movement because these veterans were all men. Now, when it comes to how fascism deals with gender today, it's simply the case that almost all fascist movements, almost all fascist recruits and leaders are men. It's no longer the case that the vast majority of them are veterans, although very many of them are. But the sexist, the gendered nature of fascism is something that is definitively universal, whereas a lot of other things that people describe as being universal to fascism, for example, white supremacism or racism or even being Christian, those are not universal. Whereas essentially every fascist movement that I have ever heard of is extremely sexist, very, very much organized around gender and power. And this is because fascists are obsessed with sort of militarized violence, paramilitary violence. They're obsessed with honor and soldiery. You know, they think about themselves as being domestic soldiers fighting a domestic war. And all of that imagery, all of those ideas, those are all very, very gendered. Fascists also believe that men and boys should be in control of society, and they see feminism as one of their biggest and most inherent enemies. However, this does mean that fascism has a pretty complicated relationship to homosexuality. There have been homosexual fascist movements, and even back in the 2016, 2017 early days of the new nascent fascist movement in the United States in the wake of the first Trump administration, there were a number of out homosexual men who were involved in that movement. They have since receded to the background or claimed that they have been deconverted, you know, literally prayed the gay away. But fascism has always had this complicated relationship to male homosexuality because they can interpret it through through a sexist lens, as in like a way to avoid women altogether. Hmm. So it's a really interesting, strange aspect of things.
Right. One term or turn of phrase that we see repeatedly as you are talking about the fascist movement here and in other places, we often see the words dissatisfied youth or disaffected youth, or we see the word blame, or we might see the word resentment. So it sounds like it's fair to say that this movement, this ideology, springs first and foremost from a place of intense dissatisfaction and unhappiness. That it would be sort of a contradiction in terms to think of a happy person as a fascist, although I suppose a fascist could derive some pleasure from the activity that they are engaging in. I mean, they see it as being a positive force for strengthening what has been weakened. But otherwise, it sounds like you were describing something that really comes from a dark, sad, angry place emotionally.
Absolutely. Fascists typically are people, like many revolutionaries, people who are deeply dissatisfied with how the world is working. Because fascism is so inflected with maleness and often with male youth, or at least with ideas of male youth, or it's about young men, even if the fascists in question are themselves not young. The idea here is that fascists look around at the world and, I would say accurately, say that it is not going to be a good one for the young people alive today, right? The world is burning. The economy is not a good one for young people. It is almost impossible to purchase a home. It is hard to start a family. It's hard to get a good job. You know, all of these things are true. Fascists look around and they put the blame in the wrong place, right? They say that the blame is, in the United States, they would blame feminism, you know, that women are taking jobs that they think are rightfully belonging to men. They would say the same thing about people of color, that people that they think are undeserving, literally because they are not white. They think that those people have taken jobs that should belong to white men. You know, that's what they believe. And so young men who are dissatisfied, who are downwardly mobile, you know, they're not going to be as well off economically as their parents are, either themselves specifically or in their generation. And they look at the world and they say, like, well, what's in it for me? You know, who's going to be protecting my interests? And this is the big problem with fascist recruitment, is that there is a kernel of accuracy there. They have accurately identified some experienced problems with the world. The world is not going to be as good for young men today as it was for me when I grew up in the 1990s, or as it was for many other people who grew up in previous decades, right? It simply isn't. And we all know this, And so we can't really argue with them on that front. Fascists have this kernel there, and then they spin it out into something heinous, something really hateful, destructive, disgusting, using this kernel of truth to prescribe, hell on earth, basically.
Right. And one of the points that you make is that for anybody who wants to fight against fascism, and in particular for anyone who wants to prevent more young people from falling under its spell, anybody with that concern needs to understand this fundamental appeal of fascism. If you think of it only in its most monstrous terms, then you are going to be blind to why it makes this connection so effectively. The hurt or sense of insult that so many men feel, if we can't come to terms with that, talk about that openly, then the dialogue that you call for in this book simply can't happen or won't be effective.
Absolutely. I think that there is a really, in my opinion, wrong tendency in people to try to explain the appeal of fascism away. You know, they try to explain it away as mental delusion or even as mental illness. They try to retroactively diagnose fascists with, borderline personality disorder or something like that. I think that that's simply wrong. Not only is it, wrong to ascribe, to retroactively diagnose people, but it's also wrong to think about political action that seems to be very sincerely held as being something that, that's simply, they made a mistake, they've been deluded. They're just wrong. Somebody got to them. They've been lied to. Instead, we have to take the harder road and say to ourselves, people believe this. They really believe it. It's important to them. They care about it. It provides them with meaning. It explains the world to them. It's an ideology just like any other. That's much scarier. But as a historian, I regret to inform you that usually, or at least very often, the scarier way of thinking about things is often the most accurate.
Right. You point out a couple of ways in which we tend to think of the dramatic rise in the number of young fascists as directly attributable to the fact that now we have the internet, or to the fact that we now have fewer groups that are collectively known as civil society. I mean, sports leagues and church meetings and clubs and so on, that those do not exist as much as they once did. And so it's a vacuum which is being filled and so on. You're quick to point out that while that explains part of it, it does not explain all of it, because fascism has had strong influence on a certain type of young man long before either of those factors were in place. I'm just curious why you think it is so important to make that point, because you make it repeatedly in your book and effectively. But what is the danger of attributing too much of this to social media or the absence of civic groups and so on? What's the problem with doing that?
You're absolutely right that is one of my pet causes, and it's because I think that misdiagnosing the problem means that you will get the wrong prescription. If you think that a lack of civil society is the cause of fascism, first of all, yes, you've misdiagnosed the problem. Because we know, historically, that fascists have actually been the most successful at organizing in places that have very strong civil societies. Fascism is a political movement, just like any other. How do political movements grow? Well, they grow in community. That's just how they've always worked. And so if you have strong communal ties, it's easier to grow political movements. It's harder in sort of like anonymized political situations. Something that we see accurately represented in data and in theory from thinking about fascism in the past, as in back in the 1920s and 30s, it's also something that we see today. The other misdiagnosis that you pointed out that I sort of harp on a little bit is blaming the internet. I think that, you know, if you had read, for example, an op-ed in the New York Times or some paper like it back in the 1920s and 30s, and you were blaming fascism on the radio, you would say to yourself, like, well, but the radio is just how people communicate. So all you're saying is that fascists are a political movement, and they use whatever the most advanced communication tool available to them is. Well, of course they do. Everybody does. That's not unique or special. There isn't something about that medium of communication that means that it has to be fascist, right? They're just smart political operatives. They're doing it on purpose, and they're being very good at it. Anybody could do that. There isn't something inherently fascist about it, you know? That's something that people often hear in high school, you know, that like the radio lended itself to Hitler's type of organizing. And, you know, Hitler was a particularly good public speaker, but that doesn't mean that the appearance of the radio caused fascism, right? And in the same way, the appearance of the online internet forum or text messaging or, you know, algorithmically derived YouTube series, like, that doesn't cause fascism. It's a way that people encounter fascist messaging because fascists intentionally put it out there to try to galvanize people, which is using whatever tools they have available to them. And so if we misdiagnose the problem, I think that we misunderstand what the solutions can be.
You write at one point, so when you think about fascism, don't think about it as some kind of empty, evil space that can only be filled with monsters who have lost their hearts and souls. Fascism is a political movement built in exactly the same way as any other, by giving the people in it a sense of belonging and purpose, a meaningful community to join, and a clear set of goals for the future. This is one of the greatest dangers that fascism poses, especially for isolated, disaffected, lonely young people. Aside from their violence and angry rhetoric, they offer young men something real, community. Which brings to mind something else that you say when you describe a certain young fascist. I think this is the story of someone in Germany, actually, back in the late 20s. But in completing that particular story, which we don't need to explore in this interview, you write, he fell so completely into the world of right-wing street violence that it became his entire identity. He dropped out of school, left his everyday life, and devoted all of his energies to the movement. Can I assume that this is a common thread, that very seldom are we going to be talking about someone who is a wide receiver on the high school's football team, or someone who sings tenor in the choir, that this is going to be, at least for the most part, young people who are kind of on the fringes, feeling left out, feeling frustrated, vulnerable, angry, and so on. I mean, not that a young man can't be involved in activities and still be vulnerable to some of those feelings, but by and large, are we talking about people who allow this, in fact, want this to engulf their lives and their entire identities?
I think that there are two types of people that we're talking about here. One of them is this example, this historical person. His name was Horst Wessel. He is of a type of fascist that, like, is perhaps the scariest if you're dealing with him. You know, he was a real true believer. It became his whole life. If you are dealing with a young person today who has fallen that far deep, it will be a lot harder to pull them out of it, because fascism becomes their whole community. So you have to replace that if you want them to get out of it. I think that most people who fall into fascism are not like that. Most of them are people who, you know, maybe this provides some framework of meaning or unity or connection. Maybe it's part of their social world, but it's not their whole entire identity, right? For most young people who get influenced by this messaging, and, you know, maybe they voted for Donald Trump, and maybe they show up for a rally or two, or maybe they post some unsavory things on social media, for most people, that's where it is. It becomes part of how they think about the world, but it doesn't become their entire world. Fascist organizers are this former type. You know, it becomes their whole life and universe. But if we're talking about, you know, the young men who voted disproportionately for Donald Trump as opposed to Kamala Harris or Hillary Clinton, then we are primarily talking about this other type, people who just, you know, are sort of like along for the ride, you know, your generalized converts. And I have different, you know, there's different things that you can do to intervene in the lives of these different people in order to pull them out of this rabbit hole.
We're speaking with Craig A. Johnson about his book, How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. And that is what we need to turn to now, because, of course, much of your book explores this. And we should probably also reiterate that it is certainly within the realm of possibility for people other than young men to fall prey to this, to become followers, but that fascist organizations recruit intensely young men, and for some of the reasons that we've already discussed. So your book goes from this introduction of fascism and what it is to exploring some ways in which there can be an intervention of sorts. One of the things that you talk about that I think is so intriguing is to compare a conversation that a parent might have with, for instance, their adolescent son about this versus having a talk about don't do drugs or don't engage in unprotected sex or don't drink and drive or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how there are similarities and yet some interesting differences. Just talk for a moment about what this kind of conversation is likely to look like and feel like.
So you're right that I think that the closest comparison to how to talk to your son about fascism is those kinds of parenting conversations, you know, about sexual health, about sexual violence, about racism, about things like that, you know, difficult conversations that you have to have with a kid starting maybe around when they're 12, but continuing throughout their adolescence and even their young adulthood, you know, maybe even into their early 20s. You might be still helping them through these kinds of things. In the same way, you're sort of warning them against things that society is coming out for you, right? You know, like society might encourage sexually violent behavior or sexually presumptive behavior, and you're trying to help your young son be like, okay, but you need to practice consent culture. Ask for consent before you engage in XYZ activity. You need to be careful about sexually transmitted infections, et cetera, right? In the same way, your first conversations with your son need to be getting out ahead of it, you know, helping him understand that this messaging is out there for him. He is going to encounter it. Come to me if you hear about it. If you're curious about this thing, talk to me about it. Share this meme with me. Tell me that joke that you heard that people laughed at and you didn't understand why it was funny. Make sure that they know that you're a safe person to talk to, right? In exactly the same way as you want to be a safe place that your son can make a mistake, can mess up, and you help him get back on the right track, right? The other big comparison here is, like, let's imagine that you're dealing with a young person, a son, somebody on a team you coach, somebody in a faith community you're a part of, whatever, somebody you're mentoring, right? Let's imagine you're dealing with a young person who has had a drug problem, you know, maybe it's severe, maybe it's not yet severe. They're having a hard time. They made some mistakes. It's up to you to evaluate, you know, is this person safe to be in my community? Do I trust them around other people? Do I trust them around money, et cetera? But you know all the questions you have about a person who's having a drug problem. A person who's fallen pretty deep into fascism, you have to ask yourself the same question. Am I safe around them? Are they safe around themselves? Are they safe around other people? Have they atoned? Are they actually sorry? Do they want to make amends? Right? It's the same question. And you have to make yourself, you know, sort of the same evaluation and produce the same boundary, right? If you are willing to make amends, if you're willing to do right, to apologize, to try to show up to people in the way that you need to, then yeah, you can come back into my community. But until then, maybe there isn't space for you. Maybe it's not safe for other people. And that's the evaluation you have to make. It's a very similar calculus.
Speaking of calculus, one of the things you also talk about beyond, you know, how do you sit down with your young son and talk about this, is that you draw a very interesting distinction between what we're talking about in terms of parent to a son versus battling fascism, working to stop fascism in public, in the public sphere.
Yes.
That, of course, what just now we're talking about is a private dialogue, a private conversation. Explain why that distinction is so important to remember.
Absolutely. I think this is one of the biggest and most important things to remember when you're thinking about fascism. Most people who talk about fascism, most guides you see about what to do about it, are about fighting fascism in public. You know, they'll tell you that when fascists show up to protest in your city, you have to show up against them. You know, you have to yell and scream. You have to take up space, because otherwise they'll be the voices that are heard. They will be the people out on the streets taking over your city. And that's true, right? When fascists are in your election, you have to show up and vote against them. That's true, absolutely. But fascism, but that's all fighting fascism in the public world, right? Where they are on equal footing with you. Fighting fascism in private is entirely different. If you have a young son, a young kid in your life, maybe a nephew, whatever, and he says a racist joke, or he says that he likes, you know, Andrew Tate, a right-wing influencer right now, if what you do is you scream at him and tell him to get out, well, that's only going to drive him further into this ideology, this fascist community that he's found, right? That's just not going to work. Instead, you have to call him in. You have to say, like, well, I don't agree with that. I don't like that. I don't listen to that. Where did you find it? What do you get out of it? What does it provide you? You know, are your friends doing this? Are you losing friends over this? You know, where did you encounter this? What do you like about it? What do you find appealing about it? You have to engage with him about this. And this is true for anybody in your life who is dealing with this stuff, you know, who's falling into this rabbit hole. You know, maybe you could use this on an uncle, on a father as well. But it's uniquely important and powerful for a young person, because young people, despite what they might say or believe, do look up to older folks for examples, for how to deal with problems. And fascism is uniquely incapable of dealing well with empathy, with real, true, actual empathy. Fascists will prepare young people for being screamed at. They'll prepare them for being kicked out of a house. But one of the things that they will not prepare them for is being called in and saying, like, hey, I'm scared about what's happening to you. Something's happening. You know, you have gotten involved in this scary thing, and I want to talk to you about it. Where does it come from? What do you like about it? I still love you. I'm still here for you if you want to make right. That's something that they're not prepared for.
One of the matters that you also talk about is the matter of prevention, and that there are, I'm sure, all kinds of parents and teachers and mentors and others who would like to construct some kind of shielding, some kind of protection, so that the young person is not exposed to any of this in the first place. You say that one of the problems with that, I mean, aside from it being all but impossible, is that when you make something completely taboo, that often for a young person makes it all the more beguiling. So one has to be extremely cautious when it comes to this.
Oh, absolutely. I think that you can't tell a young person that they can't think something, that they're not allowed to think or talk about something. That will only make it more enticing for them. That'll only make it more curious, more exciting. Transgressive comedy is just an inherent part of young people's culture, you know, and has been since the 1960s, the 1940s, the 1920s, right? You have to understand that and know that for some people, that's all it is. You know, they're trying to get a rise out of you. And if you give them that, if you say, like, no, you're not allowed to think or believe these things, yeah, it will become more interesting, more curious for them. Instead, you have to respond to it, you know, fairly seriously and stoically. You know, I don't understand what's funny about that joke. Do you want to talk about it? Do you want to explain it to me? Do you understand what's supposed to be funny about that joke? You know, if you try to circumscribe it, if you try to prevent it, then it'll just become more interesting. And as you said at the top, the other aspect of that is that it is simply impossible to keep a young person from encountering these things unless you live in an isolated communist commune, you know, maybe in the mountains or something, but even then, they'll probably see it.
Your book goes on to list, among other things, various warning signs, things for parents to look at that include, of course, dramatic shifts in who they are hanging out with, their behaviors, their demeanor, and other things. It's a much longer list than that. Your book includes a long list of various players in fascism, various groups, and certain influencers, and so on. You also list some groups that have been designed, that is, organizations designed to try to combat this. And you point out that once in a while there can be a problem with that, because you have young people who have fallen prey to fascism seeking to be, in a sense, rehabilitated, and just being around each other can be kind of a complicated situation. So there are all kinds of things that need to be thought about in terms of how to do this, and you even go so far as to talk about the various stages in terms of if someone seems to be just mildly interested or intrigued versus fully committed. Your book explores all of this and more. More than once, you call for parents, as they are thinking about doing this, to retain a spirit of curiosity and humility. I think for some readers that might come as a surprise. What is valuable about those two qualities when we're talking about this?
Yeah, I don't mean curiosity or humility about fascism. Like, you shouldn't be open to this new ideology and think like, oh, what does it have to offer me? Like, that's not what I'm suggesting. What I'm instead suggesting is curiosity and humility about your son or about the young person that you're talking to. You have to be open to the thought about, like, well, what does he get out of this? What does he find interesting about it? What is it that's speaking to him here? And if you come in already assuming that you know, then he's going to shut down. He's not going to open up to you, and you won't be able to build the kind of relationship that you'll need in order to draw him out of this world. You have to experience real curiosity, you know. What is it about these jokes that he finds funny? What is it about these communities that he finds interesting? What is it about his life right now where he's finding something here? You know, what is it that he's finding? And you have to be open to having all sorts of answers to that. You know, it might be that he's feeling alone in school. It might be that he's questioning, you know, his beliefs, his ideas, in a way that all young people do. And fascism is simply one of the ones that's around right now, and he isn't fully aware, he isn't fully on board with how evil it is. It's part of your job to help him see that, but he's exploring things. That might simply be the case. The other thing here is that when it comes to young people encountering fascism, that, you know, as I said, they simply might just not know the dangers here. They might not know the history. They might not really fully understand it. And as young people, their brains are not really fully developed in a very literal sense. They're not yet capable of the same kind of systemic long-term thinking and calculus that older people can do. And so that's part of what you have to do. You have to help him and say, like, okay, but, like, think this through. What happens next? What happens if you join one of these organizations? What happens to me? What happens to your sister? What happens to your aunt, right? You have to help them walk through these questions. That's the kind of curiosity, the kind of humility that I'm asking people to bring to this conversation.
The book, again, is How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. It is published by Routledge Studies in Fascism and the Far Right. The author, Craig A. Johnson, whose podcast is called 15 Minutes of Fascism. Craig A. Johnson, thank you so much for creating this book and for all the work that you're doing on this important cause, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure to speak with you. A really, really excellent, curious conversation. Thank you very much.
And tomorrow on the morning show, we will pay tribute to American journalist and political commentator Bill Moyers, who died this past Thursday. Today's going to be sunny, hot, and humid. We'll have a high temperature today in the mid-80s. Overnight, low of 65 degrees under clear skies. Sunny again tomorrow and warming to a high of 87 degrees. Even warmer on Thursday, a high of 89 with a 30% chance of afternoon rain. Sunny and quite hot on the 4th of July, high of 91. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.